Kate Carte, who is a professor at Southern Methodist University, professor of history at Southern Methodist University, and she's written a few books, most recently Religion in the American Revolution and Imperial History, which was published in 2021. It was actually a pretty good, smooth read. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
We are going to be asking a lot of things about the American Revolution and religion and all sorts of cool stuff. So why don't we just jump right into it? First, I'd love to know why religion and history in particular.
You know, so I think of religion pretty expansively. I think of it as a pretty broad topic. And I think of it most importantly as where people park what's really important to them. So sometimes that's, you know, belief about sort of larger powers or whatever, but sometimes that's, you know, having really strong feelings about gender relations or, you know, ritual or certain spaces or something like that. So it's a way to look at what people consider so special that they want to kind of protect it and guard it under that category.
That sounds like it fits really well into a rebellious revolutionary spirit. So that's
absolutely.
Cool. I was really excited to talk to you too, because religion isn't one of those things that you hear a lot about in the American Revolution, and specifically the Great Awakening that had a huge impact on the people's minds and kind of like this, we don't need a church authority or the government to give us our happiness and determine our life. We can have our own relationship with ourselves and our destiny. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Great Awakening was and how that might have influenced people's ideas around the revolution?
Well, so the Great Awakening, when we use that term, what we're referring to is this kind of transformative moment for Protestants. So those are Western Christians who aren't Catholic. Transformative moment for them in kind of the early part of the 18th century. And what really happens is a theological change where people start questioning whether specific creeds are what's really important, and if perhaps what's most important is how they can directly connect to the divine, but especially they focus on Jesus, right? So it's a movement that is kind of democratizing in the sense that an individual's personal religious experience is really important, and that's more important to them than whether they can kind of recite a catechism from a church authority. And it also questions how you decide if someone's going to be an appropriate minister for your church. So there are people within the Awakened tradition that question whether just having gone to seminary and been ordained is enough to mean that you're truly saved, right? This is when we get the language of being born again. This is when that kind of movement starts. So they say, well, you need to be going to a pastor who's born again. If you're not going to a pastor who's born again, then you can be led astray. So you as a congregant need to be able to pick your minister. You can't just be assigned because you live in a certain district, right? So all of that has a kind of democratizing impulse to it. Historians have tried really hard to find direct connections between that and the revolution, and they turn out to be really hard to find because individuals who belong to awakened churches were not particularly more likely to revolt. So it's kind of a loose connection. One connection might be that the American Revolution or the Great Awakening was something that happened in lots of colonies, and that might have created connections between people in more distant places. You know, John Adams famously says that the challenge is getting 13 clocks to strike together, right? And in that sense, it's something that convinces people in all 13 of those colonies that they have something in common. So that might be part of it. It's also when we see kind of big crowds. But the people who were in awakened movements tended to kind of keep that, let's say they weren't disproportionately likely to be angry at the British over taxes.
I was going to ask about that, if there were any specific denominations that kind of favored the rebellion or were specifically against it. Was there any kind of like divisiveness among religious denominations over that issue at all?
You know, to a certain extent there was, although whether it has to do with exactly how it connects to those religious groups is a thornier question. But in New England, there was a more, people in New England were both religiously and politically more likely to question the king's authority. And partly that's because they come from the Puritan tradition, and the Puritan tradition, you know, in the English Civil War, the Puritans overthrew the king, right? So there's a connection there. It's also because there's less royal authority in New England, just kind of structurally in the way those colonies' governments are structured. So they're a little bit protected from royal authority. So it's easier for them to resist the king. Yeah. So you do see the strongest and most unified rebellion in the what I think of as the post-Puritan colonies. So Connecticut and Massachusetts, you know, up in New England. But then in Virginia, so Anglicans, people members of the Church of England, tend to be more likely to support the British. Certainly Church of England ministers tend to be more likely to support the British. But then you have a colony like Virginia, where the Church of England is the established church. But most people, most white people, were pretty unified behind behind the resistance. George Washington was a member of the Church of England. Thomas Jefferson grew up in that tradition. James Madison, right? All of these guys who are real kind of active rebels or theorists of rebellion. They come from that Anglican tradition. So you can't say like uniformly members of the Church of England were less likely to rebel. But, you know, in the North, members of the Church of England were less likely.
But that's a really good explanation. And I kind of wanted to jump on that and ask, did it give people a sense of individualism that kind of pulled them away from their own, like, you belong to this parish and this is your church and this is your congregation, and kind of this idea of you need to seek God on your own without somebody telling you, you need to have that personal connection. And sometimes people say that that could have influenced America's, you know, individualism kind of spirit. What do you think about that?
You know, I think that's really true in the period after the American Revolution. But, you know, for the moment of the revolution, the challenge is not getting people to be separated. It's getting them to stick together, right? And, you know, you think about the revolution, you know, it's a war. It's an 8-year violent conflict where people lose economic opportunities. They lose family members. They're dislocated. They're divided from their friends and relatives by all kinds of, you know, sort of upheaval. So all of those things, what if you want to get that revolution going, if you're behind the revolution, what you really need is for people to put individualism aside and to stick with the war, especially people like soldiers who are getting paid in, you know, devaluing scrip or, you know, all that kind of stuff, that you need people to stick together. So in the revolutionary moment, what we see is the leaders of the Continental Congress and some of the revolutionary governments, a lot of the revolutionary governments, using what I would call public religion in order to unite people. So they, there's a very famous moment of prayer at the First Continental Congress where they say, well, we should sanctify these events with prayer. And they get a member of the Church of England to come and lead them in that prayer. And Samuel Adams, who is definitely not a member of the Church of England, he's a, you know, kind of late Puritan. He's kind of a crusty old guy. And he says, I can listen to even a Church of England minister if he's a friend to his country. And you start hearing people saying in, you know, in other contexts too, in other sermons saying, you know, our religious differences are less important than our ability to hang together as people who are loyal to the American cause, and that's what God wants. You know, it's providential. God's on our side. So they're using religion very intentionally to pull people together and to convince them that this thing that they're doing, which is, you know, illegal in every possible commonsensical way and dangerous, that it's going to be worth it, that it's the righteous thing to do, even though they're risking so much. So when we're looking at, you know, especially 74, 75, 76, we're looking at religion trying to pull people, using it to, you know, pull together. But then once you have, you know, one of the big outcomes of the American Revolution is the disestablishment of state churches, right? So that you get a lot more religious freedom. And then people start really connecting that religious freedom to being an American and saying, you know, if you think, you know, so Jews have full citizenship rights at the federal level in the United States after the American Revolution. It's like the first time they've had that. And so for them, you know, the American Revolution and the new Constitution in 1787 gives them something really powerful that's also an individual thing. And it's an individual right and lets them express their beliefs in their own ways, yeah. Right? So that's really powerful.
Yeah. Do you think that kind of was the need to unify people was one of the factors that went into granting religious freedom eventually?
Absolutely. The founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, the leaders of state governments were very clear that religion was something that could tear people apart. They go from using it as a tool to pull people together to being very frightened that if they try to make rules around religion, it'll atomize people. If they try to put in, any state church, it just is a thought experiment, which church could have been a national church for the new United States? There isn't one that could have held everyone together because they're regional in focus. And so it would have, you would have had people from different states saying, I won't be part of that union, right? And so it very much, they back away from religious establishment on a practical level because they need to unify people. And they really want, we sometimes, I think, forget the most basic thing about the framers of the Constitution. They wanted the government to succeed. They were willing to compromise to make it succeed. And so anything that threatened that, especially things like trying to dictate faith to different groups of people across the country, they weren't going to touch.
Absolutely. They definitely had a lot of brilliant ideas about foreseeing potential trouble. And on that note, I know in the first Continental Congress, there was issues over great fears about Catholics in Canada because, Britain had just won the French and Indian War, in the Seven Years' War, they got Canada, but there's all these Catholics that live there, even though Britain rules over it. And can you kind of explain a little about the fear? There was a lot of fear and arguments and debates in that Congress about they're going to come get us. What was that fear based on?
Anti-Catholicism is such an interesting thing because in the world we live in today, we've got a Catholic president of the United States, and he's not the first one, right? So we're so comfortable with the idea that Catholics are, good citizens, and that there's no conflict between citizenship and being an American and being a Catholic. That's really not how the British felt in the 18th century. So for the entire 18th century, going back to 1689, the Glorious Revolution, British political life was set in opposition to what they saw as the transcendent religious and geopolitical threat of the French Catholic Empire and the Spanish Catholic Empire. And they, in kind of theological terms, they viewed they viewed the French Empire as potentially representing kind of an ultimate monarchy that would try to, take over the world. They see the Antichrist various places in this. So it's really a kind of transcendent fight. And the idea that Protestant states would fight against Catholic states was really deeply built into the British kind of public DNA. But then what happens in the colonies is because the French and the Spanish so often fight with indigenous allies, of course, the British do too. And the French have been really successful in converting indigenous people to Catholicism. There's this sense that Catholics are also savage and indigenous people. So when they're afraid of Catholics, they're afraid of a kind of savagery. And then the other piece of it is that they convince themselves that Catholics are incapable of being free because they are raised in a state of tyranny. And if you don't learn to manage freedom, you can't manage freedom. To get really specific, and I think this is a great example, they have this idea. Protestants will tell you over and over again, it's totally not true, but they will tell you over and over again in the 18th century that the Pope has given Catholics an exemption from being faithful to an oath to a Protestant, that oaths only count if you make them to Catholic or to other Catholics. And oaths are the basis of the social order, right? You swear allegiance to the king, you swear allegiance when you're in a courtroom, right? So, and it's supposed to be a kind of spiritual thing. When you swear on the Bible, you're bringing God into that oath so that if you lie, then you'll be damned for it, right? There are real consequences. So if the Pope has released all Catholics from any kind of responsibility for their words, they are essentially treacherous. There are no consequences to them
And
for
it wasn't
lying.
true. The Pope didn't do that at
No,
that time.
totally not true. Totally not true. But British Protestants in the colonies and in Britain believed that Catholics were essentially subjects of tyranny, that they would then perpetrate tyranny and that they couldn't be trusted. So when the British Empire gives religious freedom to the Catholics in Quebec, it scares the sort of older British colonists, partly because they're worried about those Catholics in Quebec. Although they're a little more flexible on the Quebecois because they think they might come on their side. What they're really scared is that that might mean that the highest levels of the British government, the king, his ministers, that they are actually secret papists. And there are pictures, cartoons of King George III, British cartoons of King George III in monk's robes with the Glorious Revolution or the British Constitution, documents that say those words, that he's been using them as toilet paper, or he's been using, or they're under Whoa. His feet or something. So he is essentially a crypto Catholic who's going to take away all the British rights, right? Wow. So, and Americans imbibe this too. So there's a lot of fear of Catholics. It's a little bit less of actual Catholic people than it is like what Catholics represent. It's almost like a buzzword for what we think of as, when people say someone's a socialist today, they're usually not talking about some sort of deep understanding of Marx, right? It's not like they're this person has a Hegelian understanding of history, and here's it's a buzzword that means this person can't be trusted. This person's view of government is essentially different from ours, and they have to be kept away.
And there used to be those tests where, in order to even be anybody in the government, to have any position in the government, you had to take this religious oath. I don't know if that applied to all the colonies, but our season one focuses a lot on Virginia. And there was those tests in Virginia, and Catholics couldn't take those tests. I'm assuming that's kind of what you're saying. Like,
absolutely.
How can you swear an oath to the government when you're beholden to the Pope and you can do whatever you want? That's interesting. Did that
absolutely
apply to other colonies as well?
It applies to every colony, including the ones we think of as having religious freedom. So including Rhode Island and Pennsylvania. So, in those colonies also, Catholics could not hold office. Catholics could not be naturalized as citizens within the British Empire. So if a Catholic migrated to the British Empire, or if a person migrates to the British Empire, they have to get a certificate from a Protestant minister in order to be naturalized. So Catholics could not be naturalized. Wow. There are some Catholics that practice their faith privately. So it's not that there are no Catholics. And Jews are kind of in the same space, right? They can practice what they do at home, and they're not usually in the colonies. They're not usually persecuted. Like, they're not going to be, their property isn't going to be seized, that kind of stuff. But they do not have full citizenship rights.
Well, how did that play out, like in Maryland, which was like established with a bunch of Catholics?
It was, but
a weird one way, like that's always kind of forgotten about. I feel like
it is. It's established as a place for freedom for Catholics, but then they lose it, right? And it has an Anglican establishment, and it has some protections for Catholics, but not full citizenship rights, right?
That's
so there are real restrictions there for across the entire British Empire.
A lot of people don't know that, about just how much Catholics were persecuted in
absolutely
American colonial life, and even for a while after that, they're still in Christianity and othering.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then there's this really fascinating process during the Revolutionary Era, when the different states are trying to figure out, when they want to have tests for religious office. Of course, the federal constitution says no tests for religious office, but at the state level, they're playing with them. And in some places, they say you have to believe in the divinity of both the Old and New Testament, right? So then they're excluding Jews, but they'll let Catholics in. Some places, they'll say you need to believe in a state of, Pennsylvania says, you need to believe in a state of ultimate rewards and punishments, because that's the piece that has become, very important. Some will say you need to believe in the divinity of Jesus. But, that rules out Unitarians, and the Unitarian movement is growing, right? So, and of course, all of these, and this is one of the reasons why people move towards religious freedom, all of these things are contingent on the sincerity of the person who's taking the oath, right? If you don't care and you'll just say whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that becomes sort of the effective policy, is, people aren't following this anyway. So why should we have these policies?
Kind of today you see that. So I find it a little odd in court how some courts will still say, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help you God? And some say under penalty of perjury. And I think it's kind of strange how some courts still say, so help you God, when it's like, this person might not even believe in a God. Like, this is so strange. But it's kind of like a remnant, I feel.
Yeah.
Like, from, yeah. Would you say, when people say that this country was founded on Protestantism. There is kind of an element of truth to that, that even though there's religious freedom, a lot of our laws and systems and structures are built on ideas that came from Protestant beliefs or...
So I think the devil is in the details there in terms of what is Protestantism, right? Or what does it mean to be founded on, right? So the early United States was absolutely a post-British society. And many of the states, you know, there's a period of flux, but then they adopt British common law. And when by the time you get to the 1840s, you even get the Supreme Court, you know, saying explicitly that Christianity is a part of common law, and therefore, you know, Christianity needs to be treated with respect in the United States, right? So, there are ways that that's true. Now, if you come at it from another perspective, the people who founded the United States were revolutionaries, and they were willing to make enormous changes and to throw out enormous traditions, and also to protect traditions that were not British, right? So, the laws around slavery that were in the South do not come from British common law. They're colonial law, right? Because they don't exist in British law. So I think we shouldn't assume that they were, yes, they come out of that British tradition, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they would have said a spirit of Protestantism should guide in the future, right? I think a lot of them, some of them, you know, some in some ways they would have thought that the British system was the best and that's what should guide, whether that was Protestant or not. Others would have, been more Enlightenment focused and said, we should throw this out because it's, you know, that's not what we're doing anymore. We're a new country, right? I mean, they were revolutionaries. They were up for radical change.
That's a really good explanation. I know it's a very nuanced topic, and it's hard to say one way, and everything is so, like, okay, are we talking about Maryland, which was mostly Catholic? Are we talking about Calvinists in the North? Like, what are we talking about? Can you explain a little bit the difference between the Enlightenment ideals versus deism versus Protestantism, and how that would have affected the founding fathers? People say, you know, they were influenced by Enlightenment and Christianity and deism, and it gets really confusing a little bit. Can you just give an overall as the differences?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think the reason it's so confusing is because they're different kinds of thought. So Protestantism is a broad tradition, and it's originates from the German princes who protested at the Diet of Speyer in what is it, 1530 something, I think. Mm-hmm. And then all of the groups that grow out of that, right? So that includes the Calvinists and the Lutherans and the Anglicans and, you know, all these different groups that are Protestant. But those groups disagree on a huge number of things. In fact, they don't agree even on any key theological point. They don't agree on the divinity of Jesus. They don't agree on the process of salvation, right? So on a theological level, there's a huge amount of diversity. But they are a Northern and Western European tradition dominated by the British. And so sometimes people just kind of mean that when they say Protestant, right? They kind of mean WASPy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then the Enlightenment is a movement that is in both Protestant Europe and non-Protestant Europe. And it starts as a scientific movement, but it's a kind of intellectual revolution that says, we're in a new period. We need to rethink these things. We need to apply new philosophical tools, and we need to understand everything around us. And we're going to name everything and count everything and label everything. We're going to, you know, write dictionaries and encyclopedias so that we can understand all the things, right? It's this incredible assertion of human knowing, right? And confidence in what humans can know, right? Theologians will argue over whether humans can know anything, right? And whether human reason is faulty. That's a completely different mode of thinking. So there's no deist church, right? Deists tended to be individuals who kind of squared these various circles by saying, well, we don't really know if everything in the Bible is true. We're starting to understand that the Bible was, you know, edited and written by a bunch of guys, but we don't really want to throw out everything that has to do with divinity. And so it was a way to kind of keep something sacred while still kind of embracing this idea that humans could know everything and humans could explore. And, you know, but it's a deeply philosophical position. It's much more philosophical than it is organized, right? So it's not the kind of thing that you can, you know, go to communion for, right? So it doesn't kind of follow the rules of what we think religion does, right? When we think of religion, we think of congregations and ministers and, you know, children, you know, following little, doing little rituals and things like that. So I think they live in different spaces.
It's like an offshoot of enlightenment. It's like, you know, kind of a religious feeling that's enlightened. Okay. Exactly.
So
would you say that our founding fathers were mostly influenced by this thought, or were there, was it kind of just a few people that had that, was thinking?
You know, so I think from my perspective, we need to remember that the people of the revolutionary generation were no different than us, right? And what that means is that some of them thought deeply and hard about religion, and some of them couldn't have cared less. And some of them were like professionally assigned to deal with religion. So you see somebody like John Witherspoon, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was president of Princeton. He has some significant theological evolutions across the course of his life, but he's a, you know, a very awakened Presbyterian. You know, he's very devout. So he thinks a lot about these things, and he writes about how do you bring together, you know, kind of belief in the sacredness of scripture and Calvinism and Enlightenment thought, right? And then you have somebody like George Washington, right? George Washington's primary job is getting the army paid and keeping his army in the field. And, you know, he went to church, but he didn't take communion. He never talks about his religion. My guess is that he was the kind of person who kind of prayed privately when it was important to him, but would have been bored and walked away from any serious theological conversation, because that wasn't what excited him. And that wasn't his primary contributions to U.S. history have nothing to do with his faith. Right.
Yeah. So
we have to keep all of those pieces together. So some of these guys were and women also, some of them were thinking about the theological consequences of what was happening. A lot of them were trying to make sure that the next thing that needed to happen happened. And religion tends to kind of work on a slower track, right? It takes a while for theology to catch up with rapid fire events. And the revolution's a rapid fire event.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I want to ask you kind of a random question. You're around students a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
What is the number one question you get asked about religion in history?
That is a really interesting question. I mean, the number one question is this going to be on the test? But
well, there you go. Okay.
But about religion, you know, I think in all the years that I've been teaching, the question of slavery and religion in the revolution is always a challenge. And when we talk about, you know, was the United States founded as a Christian nation? Was, you know, were the founding fathers Christian? All of these questions, were people united by Christianity? We're not usually talking about slavery. But students and public audiences want to grapple with that question. And I think it's because in the present, theological views of slavery have changed so much from where they were in the 18th century that it's very difficult for people, whether they are, you know, liberal Christians or conservative Christians or in some other tradition, or no matter where they are, they have a really hard time understanding how the compromises that were made around slavery were made by people who were religious. So I think, you know, my sense is that Americans, the thing that we as a people are most still struggling with about the revolution is this contradiction between slavery and freedom, right? That continues to be a core part of our politics. Religion gives us a way to ask that question with kind of respect for the people who were involved, right? Instead of just saying, well, they were racist hypocrites, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure some of them were racist hypocrites, but not at any higher rate than in the rest of the population.
Yeah.
Right?
It is weird reading about all their arguments about freedom, and you're like, you're going to go, how many of all these slaves there? And so it is kind of weird to grapple with how that those thoughts exist.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you ever talk about the Second Great Awakening and the Civil War and like religious influence of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I actually think that religion plays an even bigger role in the coming of the Civil War, because religion is in two ways, both because it's so important in the way Americans frame the debate over slavery, all Americans, right? African Americans have very distinctive theological teachings that embrace freedom, and you know, white slave owners and just white Southerners have a set of pro-slavery beliefs, and Northerners come to believe that slavery is inherently wrong and that you cannot be a Christian and embrace slavery. And then all the churches split, right? And that cuts off a line of communication that's really significant in a civil society way. And so I think the fights are fought much more through religion for the Civil War than they were for the Revolution.
Absolutely. I would agree with that for sure.
Okay, just a couple more questions here before we go. One of them I like to ask all of my guests is, you focus on the 18th century, so I know you have a very big passion for that. So if you had to choose to study one or live in one, Tudor times or the 18th century, which one would you pick if you had to only pick one?
It's a hard question. Well, so usually I would, that's a great question. That is really interesting. So I would normally fall back on healthcare distinctions, but I don't think there are any significant healthcare distinctions between, I mean, you're like, it's a 50-50 if you go to a doctor in both of those periods, right? We're pre-germ theory, no birth control. So, you know, those things aren't going to make that big of a difference. I think as a tourist, I might enjoy the Tudor Stuart period better.
Everyone says that. It's so funny.
You know, but it's partly because I would hate to be like fact checking myself in the 18th century. Like, oh my gosh, I was wrong on this. I was
right. That would be a horrible nightmare. That would
absolutely.
Be oh, that's funny. Okay, my last question is: do you have anything you're working on right now that we could see from you in the future?
I am working on a project I'm super excited about. There's an orphanage in outside Savannah, Georgia. There was an orphanage in the 18th century that during the Revolution had no orphans, but it's a philanthropic project. And it was founded by George Whitefield, who was a leader in the Great Awakening. And when he died, he passed it to the Countess of Huntington, who's a Methodist leader, in a British countess. And it's basically a big plantation, and all kinds of wackiness ensues. Everybody's lying to everybody. There's a ton of enslaved people who are, you know, trying to get away. There's a slimy minister who the closest I can think of is Mr. Collins from Pride and Prejudice, the boiled potatoes guy, right?
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of sort of weird situations. And what I'm really interested in is how in that kind of chaos do people decide who to trust, right? Do you trust your co-religionists? Do you trust people you've known the longest? What if the person you've known the longest is someone who's enslaving you, but they may have more shared interest with you than, the British march through, the Americans take control, the French march through. Like, there's all kinds of chaos, right? And hardship.
Is it like a fictional book or is it?
No,
like
I'm just at the very beginning of kind of trying to sort out this very complicated story.
That is very cool. Please send me a notice when you finish that.
I will. Thank you.
Cool. Again, thank you so much for joining us. Kate Carte, hope to talk again in the future. I'd love to hear this again. You're awesome.
And thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. This has been such a pleasure. It's been great to talk to you. Good luck with everything.
Yeah, all right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.